Hello, and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is producer Irwin Allen. Born in 1916, Allen had intended on a career in journalism until the Great Depression forced him to drop out of college. He moved to Hollywood in 1938 and started producing a magazine and a radio show, the latter's success leading him to write a gossip column. This led Allen to producing television just as that medium was getting off the ground. Allen's skill at assembling different creative elements was keenly useful in 1950s Hollywood as studio power began to wane in favor of talent agencies. Allen produced Where Danger Lives with Robert Mitchum and Double Dynamite and A Girl in Every Port, both with Groucho Marx. Allen then directed a documentary, The Sea Around Us, based on the book by Rachel Carson. Despite Carson's unhappiness with the final film, leading her to never sell the rights to any of her work ever again, it won an Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. In the next several years, Allen would become a triple threat, producing, writing, and directing big-budget epics like The Lost World, 5 Weeks in a Balloon, and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. The latter was adapted into a TV series when 20th Century Fox, reeling from the financial disaster that was Cleopatra, started scaling back their film budgets. Allen kept the costs low for Voyage by reusing the sets from the movie and healthy doses of stock footage. With this template, Allen had enormous success on TV, putting his name on shows like Lost in Space, The Time Tunnel, and Land of the Giants, turning himself into what we think of now as a brand. He used that cachet to go back to the movies, where he would produce 1972's The Poseidon Adventure and 1974's The Towering Inferno, each a massive cultural-defining hit. Both films featured the same formula, borrowed from the 1970 mega hit Airport. Assemble a group of actors led by big stars, put them through a disaster, natural or otherwise, top off with big budget special effects, and see who survives. The formula was so good that other producers began to copy it. 1974's Earthquake, 1977's Roller Coaster, 1978's Avalanche, 1979's Meteor. Unfortunately, after those two blockbusters, Allen's Midas touch began to slip away. He produced and directed 1978's Swarm and 1979's Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, both box office disappointments. He tried the formula one last time with 1980's When Time Ran Out, but it too was a failure. Allen would go back to television and continue producing TV films until 1986, but the era of the Irwin Allen disaster film was over. Joining me to discuss When Time Ran Out and the career of Irwin Allen is the co-host of the Disaster Girls podcast, Amanda Smith. Hi, Amanda.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. I'm a huge fan of the Disaster Girls podcast, and so I'm very honored that you would be here to talk about this disaster movie with me.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me. It's always, one, truly bizarre to me when someone's like, yeah, I listen to your podcast, and then two, that anyone ever invites me to go anywhere, let alone onto their own podcast. So thank you.
I was on the search for, you know, movie podcasts, and because I listen to them while I go running and also while I walk my dog, and then she insists on like 9 walks a day. So I have a lot of podcast time to listen to. So, you know, one day I was just like, you know, I wonder if there's anything on like disaster movie. It just that was like a random thought, and I plug it in. I'm like, what? Oh my. And then you had like 100 episodes on top. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. So yeah, I really enjoy the show that you and Jordan Cruciola do. It's just really, really fun. I encourage anybody who's listening to this who hasn't heard it to give it a check out. But I want to find out before we start talking about Irwin Allen and When Time Ran Out, like why disaster film? How did you and Jordan get together to decide to talk about disaster movie?
Yeah, I mean, my history with disaster movies goes back to, you know, I'm a millennial, and for like growing up, my folks, one of the great like my parents' early dating stories was that it was raining very heavily in Los Angeles, and Benedict Canyon was flooding, and my dad was like, "Hey, do you want to go?" Do you want to go just drive and see the flooding in the canyon? so that's kind of the family that I come from.
Wow.
Date
night.
Yeah, that was a date night for them, apparently. And so that was kind of, so I, growing up, you know, Twister came out, and Twister's incredible. And, I was a kid in LA, and I was going to the Beverly Center one day with my mom, and they were filming Volcano there, the final scenes of Volcano there. And then Volcano subsequently traumatized me for years. So, you know, I grew up, and I loved the spectacle of it. I loved the bigness of it. I'm a science kid, so disaster movies are a great sort of turn your brain off, get to see something really big and huge and scary but not scary, and have fun while you do it. And so that's always been, I've just always loved them, even the bad, even the made for TVs. Like I'll pretty much hang with anything when it comes to a disaster movie. And then Jordan and I have been friends for many years. We have a mutual, we had a mutual best friend. And she was like, you two should get to know each other. And one of the first things that kind of came out of our friendship was that we would just yell about how much we love Volcano. Or you know, as often as you can probably hear from the podcast, Jordan's enthusiasm for something is infectious and unlimited. You know, we would sit there and we would just be talking about disaster movies we loved. And it was kind of like, we should do a podcast about this. And it took about 4 or 5 years of us occasionally having these conversations to get it together. And then we did it. And it's been such a pleasant surprise. I did never expected when we started that we'd be doing it. It started in summer of 2019. I never expected when we did it that we would still be doing it this long afterward and still have movies to talk about, which is great, and have the guests we've had, which is truly stunning.
We've gotten
really lucky with some of our guests, with all of our guests that anybody agrees to go on. But it turned out that Paul Feig is a huge disaster movie fan. So he's come on several times and like he'll message us now and say, hey, would you guys want me back? And we're going, yes. Yes, Paul Feig,
gee,
want you back
no,
to
Paul,
talk
I'm
about
sorry.
Earthquake.
We're very busy right now, Paul. I'm sorry.
No, Paul. Sorry. Not the time. But yeah, we've had like incredible guests. Cause the thing is that most of the time, almost everybody does kind of love disaster movies. There's some people who don't, but those are generally people who, you know, I don't necessarily want to associate with. They're not as much fun. So it's, you know, there's a real enthusiasm for it that it's been very fun to explore and find out that there's this shared community of other people who cannot like go through their life without every so often thinking of Aunt Meg's steak and eggs breakfast, you know?
I'm curious about your thoughts when it comes to the disaster movies, because I'm older than you. And so I grew up on, to me, Irwin Allen equals disaster movies. Like in my mind, it was like, that's what those are. And what disaster movies are giant casts of famous people being put through their paces, and a bunch of them are going to die, but some will live, and that's the movie, right? You know, so,
sure.
But in modern, you know, kind of modern disaster films, you don't really have that anymore. It's more focused on, I'd say, the disaster side of it. Like I think last year, my wife and I watched, Greenland.
What's his name?
Gerard Butler. Gerard Butler, you know.
Yeah.
And that movie's not all, that's just about the disaster. And there's like one or two stars in it, and it's not this big thing. And the other changes, of course, when I was younger, you know that, yes, a lot of this stuff is done in front of green screens, that a lot of these actors are being subbed by stunt people during the real crucial moments. Nobody's really at risk. Paul Newman was never going to die during the making of When Time Ran Out. But nevertheless, they had to do all this stuff practically. You mean when you see somebody falling, that's a real person really falling.
To jump ahead, that helicopter sequence, I'm just watching every time there's people in a helicopter, and there were just humans hanging off of
just
helicopters.
Dropping like, people off helicopters.
Are you kidding me? Where was OSHA?
Exactly. But of course, nowadays with CGI, so much of it is just, we all know it's all fake. And do you find that that has changed your view of a good disaster movie? Does it, or does it bother you at all to know that, oh, probably none of this is real? Or if it's good, you're wrapped up in the story and it doesn't matter.
You know, I think it's a mix of things. We've often talked about it on the podcast of like wanting to return to the time of practical and wanting to return to the time of the miniatures for these things versus doing a fully CGI'd sequence where it doesn't feel tangible in the same way. And I think sometimes also now what we're seeing is also this sort of, I think what's interesting with, in terms of the big cast aspect, we've seen that kind of become the territory of the superhero movie. That's where you get the cast of every single big actor.
Yep.
And then three actors who are collecting a paycheck who are, you know, 40 years older than the rest of the cast. We've really transitioned to that model with like the Marvel and the DC. I would love to see a return to that. I think that would be super fun. We just watched this movie, Supercell. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those same things of, you know, like the action movies that Bruce Willis has been getting roped into of like super cheap and kind of fly by night. And it's just to spit it out so that there's content. But it was actually surprisingly good. But it had Alec Baldwin in it in this sort of small role, showed up. He was sort of the, not quite the villain, but sort of the villain. And I was like, man, we just, this is what we need to be going back to. We need to have more of this because it's just not, you know, at the budget that we need, we want. But yeah, there's, I feel like we've lost something with all of the CGI for sure. There's a reason that Twister still looks so good today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because Jan de Bont made Helen Hunt stand on the side of a speeding car while she got hit in the face with corn. You know, that's, it looks
the key to any good movie.
Yeah, you got to hit at least three actors in the face with corn, and then you're going to get an amazing performance. It's, I think the lack of realness is, in general, in most of our movies at this point, becoming a real issue where, and that's, I think, where we're seeing some fatigue for viewers is like, you don't want to just watch rubber characters punch each other and then bounce off of buildings. And same thing with disaster movies is you don't want to watch just, you want to watch people in something where the eye can tell when it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
And then the brain doesn't feel it. And that's why I think like Greenland worked really well is that Greenland had some CGI. I really liked it. It had some CGI, but they were able to, at least to a degree, keep it, you know, you have them in cars, you have them in physical situations where you could at least then feel the sense of terror and fear versus when you just have nothing but, you know, people reacting to marks on a wall.
Right.
And I think that's very different. I'd love to see us go back to, I'd love to see a huge blockbuster, not Poseidon Adventure, but of that magnitude. I think that'd be fantastic.
Oh, man. I remember in the 90s when they were, Tim Burton was preparing Mars Attacks.
Mm.
And he had originally said that he wanted to make it like a disaster movie where I think, and yeah. I think they literally said the combo was a sci-fi version of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, which I was like,
oh,
that's everything I want in a movie, which is probably why that movie didn't make a dime because there aren't that many people like me that were excited about it. But he assembled, like, when you look at that cast and you see, oh, that you can see what he's trying to do. It's
yeah.
Jack Nicholson, Sarah Jessica Parker, Michael J. Like, he assembled quite an amazing cast for this silly thing, and you can see, oh, that's what he was trying to replicate, the kind of Irwin Allen approach of like, let's just get all these huge stars together, put them through their paces. I mean, it's like, it's Irwin Allen that managed to corral Paul Newman and Steve McQueen for their only film together.
You know,
these
yeah.
two huge titans of Hollywood, and the only movie they ever did together was in Irwin Allen's disaster movie, not some actory piece, you know?
Right. No. And I think, like, I don't know if as an actor you ever have fun on these things, but I think that I'd love to see actors having fun together with this mm-hmm. stuff, like being happy to, you know, the way that Ocean's 11 did, you know, accumulated a cast and then it was a hangout film. And I don't know, I'd love to see not a hangout film, but something with that sort of, yeah, we're going to get together all of the brightest stars in Hollywood and have a great time with it.
Yeah, and you're going to be treated really well. Irwin Allen knew how to treat his stars.
Oh,
you know,
that's key.
So
yeah.
That's probably a huge, huge part of it. So of Irwin Allen's, well, before I ask you that, can a movie, in your mind, can a disaster movie be a good disaster movie, even if it's not a good movie? Like, can it deliver the kind of things that you want, even though you're like, nah, that actually, you know, that really, you know, on paper, objectively, this is not a great movie, but it's, as a disaster movie, it's delivering what I want.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's one of the things that has been one of the most pleasant surprises is always when we watch a made for TV or, you know, sci-fi channel original. And we're like, wait, this is a great time. It's not good. Like if I recommended, there's a movie called Earthtastrophe. And if I recommended it to any normal person, they'd be like, are you out of your mind?
That title would probably.
Right. Like the title. And when we went, and that was what's so great about that title is that we went into it being like, this is going to be terrible. And then it does like some really ambitious stuff with timeline play that I was like, oh, you know what? This is a great time just because you guys are going for it. And that's the thing. Like, and that's part of one of the rules we have is no Sharknado, nothing where it's aware of how bad it's supposed
to be. Yes. Yes.
You know,
yes.
The best disaster movies aren't necessarily good, but they are earnest.
Yes.
And that's the key. Yes. You gotta, you know, that falseness I was saying about CGI, you feel it too in the falseness of someone trying to make a movie. That's why, like, even Moonfall, which is a mess of a film, but no one believes in the disaster movie in the modern era like Roland Emmerich does as a vehicle mm-hmm. for storytelling. And you can tell that even if he probably could have used someone else stepping in to be like, oh, let's scale this. Let's go with one of the three ideas you have here. even if he had that, or even without that, it's still, you can watch this movie and go, this is a movie made by somebody who really believes this is a vehicle for storytelling. And that's so important to me. That's what makes the movie. Is everyone trying? Does everyone believe this is something that is worth putting their time and energy into? And they want to, even if they know that the script sucks, or even if they know that it's not going to look good, you know, again, like to another name check is the Ice Spiders. What a ridiculous title. It is a movie about a mountainside resort that is invaded by genetically modified giant spiders. And they just attack people. And the spiders look terrible. And at one point, the only practical effects with the spiders are basically like puppet arms trying to get into a bus. And it's a great time because everyone really believes in what they're doing. And that's what you get with the Irwin Allen movies. Everyone's committed to it. Everyone, for better or worse, with this, everyone's trying really hard in this movie, you know?
Yeah.
And when time ran out, everyone's putting their best effort in, even though it's not great. but, you know, that's the key. I think that's really important, you know?
Yeah, I think there's nothing more ghastly than a movie made by people who are think they're above the material they're doing. And that you're just like, okay, you know, like, all right, yeah, you're too cool for this. Well, then why am I watching this? You know, why am I wasting time with this? So, yeah, so now I know that you have reviewed a couple of Irwin Allen movies on the show to this point. You've done Towering Inferno, and in fact, it is the name of your rating system, which is fantastic. And you've done Poseidon Adventure, and you've done The Swarm.
Yes.
We talked about this off air. You had not seen When Time Ran Out before I asked you to do this show. So I'm really dying to know. I'm sorry that volcanoes are scarring to you because this movie features a volcano.
Later on, what's great about it is that eventually, as it happens with most kids, like what became a thing that terrified me was then like, wow, I'm really fascinated by this. And I wound up going back to school for geology eventually. So I almost became a volcanologist. So it all worked out.
That's all. Own the fear. That's great.
Yeah. And I was like, wait, I'm intrigued by this thing. Like, what was terrifying about it as a child was that I knew just enough information to just become scared of things. And that was always a problem. But in this case, I saw a volcano opening up in Los Angeles, and I lived in Los Angeles. And I was like, well, I can't be sure that's not possible. And so therefore, I'm now terrified. I was a very neurotic child.
Yeah, I co-sign. So of the three of the Irwin Allens that you've seen, which one, well, what do you think just briefly of those three? I mean, The Swarm objectively is pretty terrible. It's pretty bad. I always know. In fact, if you look, if you find the movie on Amazon Prime, right, when you queue it up and it has the little graphics, somebody has made the graphic for The Swarm is caricatures of our actors, like big head caricatures, and you're like it looks like it's something out of Mad Magazine. You're like,
oh my gosh,
for a disaster film, like what a curious, like I almost feel like no, this is just garbage. So, but I mean, the other two, Poseidon Adventure and Towering Inferno, as I mentioned in the intro, were giant hits, massive industry changing hits. They won Oscars. I mean, you know, these were considered real films. What did you think of those movies?
I mean, They're great. My favorite of the two is obviously Poseidon Adventure. For me, I love that movie. I think it's incredible. It's for the scale of the movie. I think that what they accomplish is huge. And, obviously, as you know, as a listener of the podcast, Shelley Winters is for us like a patron saint. and this was the movie that introduced me to Shelley Winters, where I was just like, well, wait, I love this woman. as soon as she started speaking, and I was just like, she's fantastic. I want to spend every minute with her. So Poseidon Adventure, and I think ultimately, even though you've got the I think it's a more cohesive movie than Towering Inferno.
Mm-hmm.
Towering Inferno though definitely has spectacle in a way that Poseidon Adventure, because it's sort of contained, a little more contained, you don't quite get with Poseidon Adventure. Poseidon Adventure is much more, I think, you're afraid for the characters versus like the characters surviving, versus in Towering Inferno, you're like, well, what's going to happen to the characters, which is a weird, I'm not explaining that well, but it's much more event driven than survival driven. And, but Towering Inferno is definitely like, just what a cast, you know, it's one of those situations.
Fred Astaire is in the Towering Inferno.
Fred Astaire is just, sure, why not? And then, like, the fact that you've got so much, like, you've got so much going on. Like you said, it's Steve McQueen and Paul Newman, which is just tremendous.
Unreal.
I mean, it's just I don't know. Towering Inferno is just a lot, though, is my only thing. It's a lot to take in.
It's almost 3 hours, too. It's a long, it's a big
so
movie.
So much. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's an incredible, and I gotta say, no one lights the blue eyes of this cast more. I mean, I swear, Bill Holden, between in Towering Inferno, when I was watching, I was just like, how does Bill Holden, Paul Newman, and Steve McQueen all have the bluest eyes I've ever seen? Like, they're glowing. It was insane. I mean, when you have a movie where Faye Dunaway barely has speaking lines, you know that's a packed cast.
Yeah. And it's just one famous person. O.J. Simpson.
O.J. Simpson showing up.
It's amazing. I remember a couple of years ago reading about when they made Jason Statham and The Rock made that Hobbs and Shaw movie, sure, which I did not see. But I'd read that, like, their agents insisted that they each have exactly the same number of lines in the movie, like down to the. And I remembered rolling my eyes thinking, oh, come on, guy, like, you know, aren't you a little above this? And then I remembered, well, Newman and Steve McQueen had the same deal for Towering Inferno. So that's just a thing leading men do in Hollywood where they're kind of penny ante, like, oh, no, I can't have one less line than my co-star because, you know, that's not good for my ego.
Then I'm a supporting actor and can't have that.
Yeah.
I know. I didn't realize that about Newman and McQueen, but that makes perfect sense, but is also ridiculous.
It is. It's just going to come on for Pete's sake. So, okay. Well, all right. I love all those movies. And so I had not seen when Time Ran Out either. And I will admit to everybody here on the show that for the longest time, because I got the idea is I wanted to do Rowan Allen. That was the idea first. And then I was like, oh, I would love to talk to the ladies of Disaster Girl. That would be great combo. So that's step two. Then I'm like, well, what's his last film? And then I said, well, okay, he did go on to do TV movies in the 80s. And I'm like, well, I never know the quote rules of my own show. I'm like, well, I mean, you know, when Time Ran Out really isn't his last movie, he continued to produce movies for television, but those movies look kind of boring. And clearly this film is the end of the Irwin Allen era as we think of it, because it was the last theatrical film. So that's why we're calling it this. That said, I did not know until I sat down to watch this movie that it was not the movie I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is another movie that Paul Newman did in 1979 called Quintet, which is a Robert Altman movie, mm-hmm, which is a post-apocalyptic Ice Age movie.
What?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Oh, I'm adding that to the list.
Right. Exactly. I think it's almost completely unavailable, but I mean, it must be probably, you know, somewhere you can find it. But for some reason, the title, When Time Ran Out, and I confused it with Quintet. And I thought that that's what this movie was about, was an ice age. And so I put it on and it opens up on a Pacific island in the, you know, out in the Bahamas somewhere. And I'm like, wait, what?
Confusing. Absolutely. Like, if you were going into this expecting post-apocalyptic ice age and then opens with that, like, barren lava scape.
Yeah, no, the guy in the lava suit. Yeah, I was like, wait, what's okay? So this movie, I went into it completely fresh, which is kind of a fun way to go into something, you know, just be like, oh, wow, this is what this is. Okay. So as we said, the title is called When Time Ran Out. It came out on March 28th, 1980. I'm going to do a very brief plot synopsis and we'll go through the cast and then we'll talk about the movie. Business tycoon Shelby Gilmore, great name, played by William Holden, has built a luxury hotel on a remote Pacific island. An oil rigger on the island, Hank Anderson, Paul Newman, is being told by his scientist team that the island's active volcano is close to erupting. But Gilmore is swayed to ignore this by his partner, Bob Spangler, James Franciscus, whose own research tells him that that is an exaggeration. Gilmore is also distracted by trying to woo his secretary, Kay, Jacqueline Bisset, into marrying him, but she only has eyes for Hank. Complicating things even more is the fact that Spangler is married to Gilmore's goddaughter, Nikki, Veronica Hamill, while having an affair with an executive at the hotel, Lolani, Barbara Carrera. Lolani, in turn, is engaged to Brian, Edward Albert, the hotel's general manager. You follow that, everybody? Just as the hotel is filling with guests, the volcano erupts. The resultant tidal wave kills Hank's men, causing panic. Some of the guests try to commandeer a helicopter, but they overload it and it crashes. Hank then tells everyone the only safe place is on the other side of the island, which he admits will be difficult to get to. Many of the guests, spurred on by Bob, turn angry and reject Hank's offer. Hank, Kay, Shelby, Tom, who was blinded by a fire, Francis, and a few others decide to leave the rest back at the hotel, which quickly gets destroyed by a rain of fireballs. The road to safety collapses, leaving Hank and the others to cross a rickety wooden bridge over a river of molten lava in a desperate race against time. The cast is Paul Newman, as I said, playing Hank Anderson, Jacqueline Bisset, Kay Kirby, William Holden, plays Shelby Gilmore, James Franciscus, Bob Spangler, Veronica Hamill is Nikki. Ernest Borgnine plays a cop named Tom Conti. Red Buttons plays a crook named Francis Fendley. Burgess Meredith is an ex-circus performer named Rene Valdez. Barbara Carrera plays Alani. Edward Albert is Brian. Alex Karras is Tiny Baker. And Pat Morita plays Sam. That's just part of the cast of this movie. It was written by Carl Foreman, one of the blacklisted writers. He passed away in 1984. He had credits like Bridge on the River Kwai, High Noon, The Guns of Navarone. This movie is also his final film as a screenwriter. And it was co-also written by Sterling Siliphant, who worked on films like Village of the Damned, Telephone, The Liberation of L.B. Jones, which was the final film of William Wyler, which we covered on this very show, The Killer Elite, Over the Top, the arm wrestling movie with Sylvester Stallone, and he also wrote The Towering Inferno for for Owen Allen. And it's directed by James Goldstone, who did films like Winning with Paul Newman, Brother John, The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight, They Only Kill Their Masters. This is his final theatrical film as well. So this movie was sort of a black hole that took down a lot of careers, unfortunately. Okay, Amanda, what did you think of When Time Ran Out?
Well, I mean, when you read the list like that, it just, what a cast list. But also, why? I mean, this is definitely a movie that is trying to replicate that success of these big casts and all of that. But I'm thrilled to see Red Buttons and Ernest Borgnine reunite. There is absolutely no need for it.
It's like a whole separate movie by itself, that whole plot line.
Red Buttons has been like a bond smuggler, and Ernest Borgnine is the cop, the New York City cop who's been following him around the world, trying to, you know, catch him and finally bring him to justice, which is totally a movie I'd watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not the movie that we're watching. And, you know, we get a couple of scenes with him, and then Ernest Borgnine spends the rest of the film being led blind, like, because he's been blinded by a lava bomb, being led through the jungle by Red Buttons and just kind of clinging, holding on to him. And there's very little that actually happens with the two of them otherwise. And it's like, this is just, there, it's like every, it's like when you need to make dinner and all you have are bits and pieces of the food that you were, had made all through the rest of the week. And so you just throw it all together. That's what this is. This is that kind of a dinner mess. It was, yeah, it's, not good. And not good in a way that wasn't even like, well, this is, I can kind of, you know, sunny side up this. No, this was, Not one I will be rewatching except for the podcast. There will be no outside, like, yeah, I'll spend the night with this one and introduce it to some friends. No need. It was not, I mean, to his credit, there's some great, you know, sequences. Mm-hmm. Irwin Allen does spectacle. The whole bridge sequence is great. There's the kind of the third act is essentially these characters trying to get over a collapsing wooden bridge over a river of lava. And it works. It's, you know, it has the proper amount of spectacle. It's still a little ridiculous, but it's at least kind of the scale you're hoping for. But as a whole, the movie's a mess. I don't need to know about who's engaged to who and who's having an affair with who, because none of it matters. And none of it really affects anything. You don't spend enough time with any character to care. When Nikki, the stepdaughter of Bill Holden, and she finds out that her husband's cheating on her, and then it's too late for her to leave, and so she's gonna die in the hotel. And I'm like, okay, which is not the reaction you want from mm-hmm. those circumstances. Definitely I can see why this was the last film, because it was not Erwin Allen at his best.
Yeah, you could definitely see the formula is wearing, you know, wearing thin. And as I mentioned in the intro, you know, one of the downsides, of course, to being to cornering the market on disaster films is you can't copyright a disaster film. So once again, I mean, as I, also as I said in the intro, you know, Airport, the 1970 Airport was a massive hit. I think it even got nominated for Best Picture or something. It was a huge,
which
huge hit.
It's bizarre because it's so phenomenally boring.
Is it? Oh, I haven't seen it in a long time.
The original Airport is super boring. It's I think it's like there's several sequels after it. I think it's like Airport 75 is supposed to be the really good one. But the original Airport, we went into it being like, this is going to be great because obviously Airport, we've heard. And then just, wow, this is, it's really just like, it's just a straight drama about these people's lives. And then there happens to also be a guy with a bomb on an airplane. Mm-hmm. And which is just, none of these people's lives are interesting enough to warrant the drama around it.
It seems counterintuitive that any movie that has Dean Martin as a pilot could be boring, but I take your word for it. So, but I mean, so Erwin Allen takes that formula, right? And then he perfects it, you know, Poseidon Adventure and Towering Inferno, a 1-2 punch. But the problem is because these are not Marvel movies where only Disney can make Marvel movies.
Sure.
So everybody can make disaster movies and they did. And unfortunately, everyone else is out making disaster movies of varying qualities, which of course ruins your bread and butter, but that's not your fault. Like Erwin Allen is bringing all of his A game. He's bringing these massive budgets, these top tier talents to Poseidon Adventure and to Towering Inferno. And then you've got all these knockoffs. And if those aren't good, well, then people start going, I'm tired of the disaster movie. But it's like, well, if you're Erwin Allen, you're like, well, wait a minute. I didn't make Meteor. I didn't make Avalanche, you know, like it's like he's kind of getting ruined by his own success. And you can see the formula here is very much running thin. Now, contrary to my question to you earlier, where I said, can a movie still be a good disaster movie, even if it's not a good movie? I'm answering my own question because I really enjoyed When Time Ran Out. It is not a good movie by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. But I, like you said, it has some great sequences. I really enjoyed this cast. I mean, you know, as you said, like the Ernest Borgnine Red Buttons thing is its own movie. That is so its own movie. As Ernest Borgnine is chasing Red Buttons, you know, across the globe, which is like, what kind of budget does Ernest Borgnine's police department have that like they can send him to like you know, go vacation and capture this guy? Like, how many bonds is he you know, selling? But okay, whatever, that's fine. And I remembered, you know, the only idea I had about this movie going into it, like I said, I did thought it was a different movie than it was between pitching this to you and watching it, right? I watched that five-part documentary on HBO about Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
The Last Movie Stars, I think it's called. And that's terrific. It's really entertaining. But there's a point in it where they start talking about Paul Newman and how that his career was going kind of badly. Right. Like, and as an offhanded way to show that he was in the nadir of his career, they show a clip from this movie. And like, you know, I'm like, oh, okay. So that's the, you know, and Paul Newman, to his credit, said it was a money job. He took it because of the money. Erwin Allen offered him a ton of money and he took it. And Paul Newman does look bored in this movie. He really does look kind of, he's Paul Newman. Yeah. There's a limit to how bad he's going to be in any given movie because he's Paul Newman, but he does look pretty kind of like checked out a little bit through most of this movie, unfortunately.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, it's also a movie that doesn't ask a lot of him for the most part until that final sequence. It mostly just asks him to walk into rooms and look concerned. And wear a cowboy hat, which, you know, or that was a choice Paul made on his own. Who knows, but. Could have just been, or it was, well, you're an oil guy, so here's a cowboy hat. Yeah, it is not a good movie. I think, you know, as you talk about like Erwin Allen, that you can't corner them, you can't trademark these sorts of things. But I do think what we see in, you know, after the Towering Inferno, after the Poseidon Adventures, we start to see the Avalanche, which we've watched Avalanche and Meteor for the podcast. I liked Meteor a lot more than I liked, than I think most people do. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was Sean Connery was good in it. I thought there was like, it had a good, it was fun in a way.
I saw that movie in the theater.
Oh, wow.
It was little kid. My dad took me and my sister to see it.
Oh, amazing. That's amazing. It's crazy because, like, I mean, it's one of those things that's always, not to be a youth about this, but it's one of those things where it's always so weird to me when I realize, like, oh, this was made when Time Ran Out was made in 1980, and it feels so much older than that, which is just crazy. And then I'm like, well, this was made 5 years before I was born. This isn't like ancient history. This, you know, there are movies from this decade I remember. So it's weird how dated it does feel. And I think that that's partly from not recognizing where the success lies in the formula. And again, you know, to do another parallel to Marvel and DC films, I think there's something very similar happening now as we're seeing this sort of, you know, superhero fatigue. And I think it's partly because the seams of the structure are starting to show. And the structure was never the thing that was what made these movies great. And now, you know, reliably, you can basically pace out one of these movies by knowing exactly, or, you know, the Marvel TV shows where you know exactly what episode something's going to happen in because that's the formula.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the same thing that happened with Disaster, where they kind of, you knew there was going to be, you know, a married couple where one dies tragically and the other must carry on. And then eventually, like, you know, maybe dies on his own sacrifice. There's certain just sort of, okay, this is where this is the formula now, but that was never what made them great. And I think that sort of missing the point is maybe the greatest flaw of Irwin Allen, is that what he tried to replicate were the things that weren't what he needed to replicate, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It is weird to think, like, this movie came out like within, I think, like a month of like The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, know? Exactly.
I mean, like, wow, this is, and there's an interview. I saw some quotes from Irwin Allen where he was asked about Star Wars and he was baffled as to why it was a hit, because he was like, there's no romance. There's no stars. Why did anybody like that movie? And it's like, that just shows that his perspective was from a different era.
Yeah.
And this new era was thrust upon him and he just did not understand it. Because to him, it's like, why wouldn't you want to see Burgess Meredith and his wife as retired circus performers? And, you know, and then he's going to bounce on a bridge with a, you know, one of those bars and rescue a kid. Isn't that what everybody wants to see? Like,
everyone wants really. That, right?
Yeah. Not kind of anymore. The one thing I wanted to mention, there's a couple of those little details as I watched it over. First of all, the opening credits, right? The film features the title When Time Ran Out underlined. I've never seen that in a movie. I've never seen underlined in a title.
That's just like a weird, serious,
weird detail. I guess so. But it mentions James Franciscus as Bob Spangler. And that is something that I think I saw this in a Roger Ebert book where he talked about his Ebert's rules of movie guides. And it was like, no movie is good if it features an actor playing, like, it lists their credit on the screen, because you're like, I don't know who Bob Spangler is, and that means nothing to me. It's one thing if it's like Henry Fonda as the president, like in Tentacles. You know, you're like, okay, well, he's the president. I know what that is. But who the hell is Bob? Why is that significant? Like, I don't know who Bob Spangler is. You know, like, okay, what is that supposed to mean? And related to James Franciscus, this is something that I ashamedly never thought of until I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But, you know, that movie spends a lot of time analyzing the career of Rick Dalton, as played by Leonardo DiCaprio, who tragically just passed away, apparently, according to Quentin Tarantino. Rip Rick Dalton. But
I was going to be very confused about who. Wait, Rick Dalton was a real person?
No, but Quentin Tarantino was acting like he is. And he literally announced that he died at age 90. And people are taking it like it's real. Like, it's a real thing.
Oh, my gosh.
But yeah, no, Leonardo DiCaprio did not die, everybody. No, no, no.
I was like, I feel like because I've been offline for a little, like, for the last kind of 12, 14 hours, but I feel like I was at my 20th high school reunion, and I was like, I feel like that would have been a topic of conversation.
It would have been a news. Yeah, that's really going to kill
me.
At
a 20th high school, like a class of 2003 high school reunion, we would talk about Leo.
Yeah,
okay, that makes a lot more sense.
Sorry,
I didn't know. Okay.
Rick Dalton has passed away, but that movie spends a lot of time analyzing the career of leading men, like what leading men can and can't do. You don't want to play a villain, right? You got to be the hero if you want to stay, blah, blah, blah. And James Franciscus was not to the level of a Paul Newman or a Steve McQueen or anything like that. He was definitely like a B-level guy. That's mm-hmm. the reason he's in Beneath the Planet of the Apes playing a sort of Charlton Heston type. He's kind of the guy you get when Charlton Heston's not available. That said, right. he was a movie star. He was, you know, a leading man. His character in this movie is such a dick through the whole movie that it makes me think, why would he take this part? Because it makes him look like a it makes the actor to me look like a jackass because he's wrong at every turn. And it just almost made me feel sorry for James Franciscus. And I'm like, was he that hard up for work that he took this? Because this Bob Spangler guy is such a creep that you're like, okay, I want him to get hit by a fireball. So
I mean, I think, yeah, which it's funny because I, you know, there's the playing the meaty villain is now such a thing that we experience, that actors go for now. It never really occurred to me that would be a thing that back then, yeah, of course, that's not desirable. You want to be the white hat. Someone's always got to be the purser on the Poseidon Adventure who is leading everyone to their death. There's always got to be a purser. And yeah, no, Bob Spangler in this is, you know, there's always the character who is through his own arrogance leads to his downfall. But man, they really didn't spare Bob a single punch, did they?
Right, exactly. Like William Holden's character, he's kind of a black hat in that he doesn't listen to Paul Newman's danger. You know, he's saying, hey, look, you know, we're digging for oil and we're seeing something. We're seeing these seismic readings that are telling us there's trouble. And William Holden is like, ah, come on, I don't really believe that. Partly because Bob is, you know, he's his business partner. He's pouring poison in his ear. And he's got that whole romantic subplot, which I mentioned, where he's trying to romance Jacqueline Bisset, which I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But he's given some humanity.
Yeah.
But it's Bob Spangler is just a twirling mustache guy from the very beginning, on top of the fact that he's cheating on his wife, Veronica Hamill, which so he's just such a total creep. And I'm like, it's just, I'm kind of amazed that they didn't say, can I have some moment? No, he's just a creep.
Well, it's that same. It's the one to one of in Towering Inferno when Bill Holden in that is also, you know, it's his character is never actually nefarious. He's always sort of the good capitalist, the good builder, the guy who is trying to do well, and then it's his underlings who have made the poor decisions.
Right, they've cut corners. Right,
yeah. In Towering Inferno, it's not him; it's his son-in-law. Same situation. Who, you know, the Jared of the family, essentially, who's like cutting corners. And he's the reason that there's not the safety features and cheaper whatever's in the building. And so it's always kind of this thing of like, well, it's not his character's fault. It's that he's been misled by people he trusted. And he's ultimately a good guy trying to do the right thing. So there's always got to be that one heel character in these films. And yeah, I mean, I don't remember who played, because I can't remember who was the son-in-law. It might have been Robert Wagner. There's always that character. I think that there must have been a shift because there is the Robert, I think it was Robert Wagner was the evil son-in-law, that we see that one heel character, the true villain of the film. And it's interesting because their motivations never seem to be coming from anything more substantial than I just don't want to believe it, and right. That's it. Which I always find really interesting, that they're just like, nope, we're not going to explore why. They're not going to get into, you know, the monetary aspects or the reasons that this might be not be a good idea for them. No, he just doesn't want to believe the science. That's it. End of story.
Right. Paul Newman's character and his kind of right-hand man played by, Alex Karras, they were like, they see this stuff and they go to Bob and Bob's just like, no, that's not true. And you're like, well, okay. Like he doesn't have any counter argument. Right. Other than this volcano only erupts one every 1,000 years. Well, okay, but is there anything else you're going to base that on? No. I'm just like, okay, all right. And so I don't really get why Barbara Carrera as Lolani is so interested in him. First of all, being in a love triangle with Barbara Carrera and Veronica Hamill is for Bob a no lose situation because it's either one of those alternatives generous. Is awesome.
It's a very generous love triangle for him.
I mean, you know, that those are both good choices either way. Veronica Hamill, by the way, who I only really knew from Hill Street Blues, God, she's ravishing in this movie. I mean, she's stunning. Absolutely stunning.
It's a film of stunning women. You know,
yeah, Jekyll and Bisset.
Looking just gorgeous and having very little to do, but being beautiful while she does it. Unbelievably beautiful cast of women.
Speaking of kind of very little to do, the opening scene with Jacqueline Bisset where she's in the plane with William yes. Holden. And he, first of all, William Holden is a good 20 years older than Jacqueline Bisset. And she is his secretary on top of it. This is more problematic stuff. But he gives her the wedding ring, right? And she rolls her eyes because obviously this is not the first time that he has tried to romance her. And she's tried to kind of rebuff him, but he's not giving up. But I love that when she looks at the ring and she's like, will this make me the sixth?
Oh my
God. And then William Holden goes, the last. Which I'm like, that's not the flex that you think it is. I don't think.
Oh my God. It's such a great line. Cause yeah, it does. It's like, I know you think that's a good compliment there, Bill, but it really just conjuring up images of being the one in charge of your hospice care. Like, this is not. It's not the problem. Guys, don't propose to. My day job is selling engagement rings. And I will tell you, do not, if you are in your 60s proposing to a woman in her 30s to 40s, don't tell her that this engagement ring means she's going to be your last wife. Don't do that. No one wants that promise.
I'm very proud. I did not use that line on my wife when I proposed to her a couple of years ago. I didn't
Great give
up
choice.
Something better than that. So. Yeah,
excellent decision making there. I know when her little like, what would this make me the sixth? I was like, oh, this is interesting. She's a little like got a little barb to her. She's a little spicy about it, and I like that. And then he replies with that, and I was like, oh God.
Surprisingly, it doesn't work.
What an amazing promise! You can be my secretary and my nursemaid.
There you go.
What woman doesn't want that? Throw in and my mother, and then like really, that's the trifecta we're all hoping for in life.
So, yeah, that was like, oh, that's rough. And you know, I love William Holden. He's one of the great movie actors of the golden age, or kind of mid-golden age of Hollywood. Stalag 17. I mean, Bridge on the River Kwai was great. And to see him kind of, I don't know, just sort of like as a hapless old man a little, that made me sad. You know, I'm like, oh, he deserved better than this. And like the late period of, and we, you know, nobody knew it, but he was only a couple of years away from him from not passing away.
1 year away. I was like, how, because I couldn't, the thing about Bill Holden to me is he has a real vibrancy to him that despite his age, like what was fun, like, I mean, I'm watching him like he could have got, if I would have gotten with him, like, absolutely. I would have a harder time than Jacqueline Bisset saying no. He's, you know, charming and charismatic and incredibly handsome no matter how old he is. That's why his you know, when you're watching a Network, chemistry with Faye Dunaway is just, I mean, you want to be grossed out by the whole situation, but you're not, because it's incredible, like, that he's just sexy.
He's still William Holden.
You get why Lucy was crawling over a banquette in I Love Lucy when she saw him when they went to California. That was actually my first, like, I didn't know who he was. I just knew the name Bill Holden because of, as a kid watching I Love Lucy. And then I saw Network as a young adult and was like, oh, yeah. Okay, Lucy, I get it. Totally. Yeah, I would have done that too at Chasen's. I would have yelled, it's Bill Holden. And then tried to get into a picture with him. Absolutely. It's one of those movies where he kind of is just instructed to show up, collect the paycheck. He doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to do anything particularly physically taxing. And it's, you know, I looked up his, I didn't realize how he died, which is just my new waking nightmare.
That's terrible. Banged his head and bled to death because he was drunk and then nobody was with him. Like, awful.
And they think that he was awake. He was conscious for like 30 minutes. I was like, oof, God, okay. That's a new night terror for me. But yeah, it's one of those funny things as you watch the movie of just like, what a cast of wasted potential. An incredible cast, and every single one of them could be given so much to do, and then instead you've got basically Bill Holden having to be, you know, the Bellamy to Paul Newman. While sexually harassed, like, they don't consider it sexual harassment in those days, but while trying to haplessly propose to a woman much his junior, who has no interest in him. I mean, the fact that he knows that she, because when she's like, no, and he's like, well, it's him, isn't it? It's like, bud, you're going up against Paul Newman.
Because he's Paul Newman, yeah, of course.
Like, of course. Have some dignity. I'm sure there's at least four other women at that hotel who would happily take that very beautiful engagement ring, Bill Holden. Just do it. I mean, none of them are Jacqueline Bisset, but I promise you'll find somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the minute you find out your romantic rival is Paul Newman, you've lost. You're done.
Yeah.
It's over.
Oh, yeah.
Paul Newman. That's the end of this discussion.
I had an anxiety dream once that I was dating Chris Evans, and I found out that he cheated on me with Isa Gonzalez. And I was just like, in the dream, I was like, you know what? Yeah, fair. Yeah, go with God, man. I can't, like, I can't fault you, and I can't compete. Like, I get it. And I feel like truly that's, if your romantic rival is Paul Newman, you just gotta, no matter who you are, you just gotta go with it and be like, yeah, sorry, dude. Okay, fine. Good luck. Where's your wedding registry at? I'll buy you a present.
It's very generous of you, by the way, to give Chris the okay like that. It's very nice.
I mean, it wasn't even like I gave him the okay. It was more of just like, yeah, okay, what am I gonna do?
It's a fait accompli. I would probably
cheat on me with Isa Gonzalez too. Like, fair.
So now we mentioned, like you said, this is not a great movie, but it does feature, I think, some really terrific scenes, you know, so there's this one moment that I wanted to mention where, James Franciscus, Paul Newman, and another kind of one of the scientist guys played by John Considine. I didn't mention him in the cast. He's like another one of the scientists. They go down into this diving bell into the lava, right? And it's got a glass floor. So they can see the lava below them as they're being lowered into it, which is, first of all, that's insane. Why would you do that? Why would you build it?
You
like
know
that?
It's there. You don't need to.
Yeah, I don't. It's really hot. I don't need to know. I don't need to see the lava. But that scene as it's being lowered, and of course, it starts to malfunction. You know, I mean, of course it does, because you know it's going to, and we're seeing, you know, like, and the guy up in the control booth is like, I don't understand what's going on. And we see our three actors, and they're starting to, like, you know, pat the sweat beads on their heads. I'm like, it's getting kind of hot here. All right, you turn the air up. No. Like, that sequence is great. It's nail biting. And it was sort of funny because I watched the movie for the third time. God, the things I do for this show. I watched the movie the third time the other day. And like, my wife was walking by and she was sort of like rolling her eyes, like, oh, this movie. And it happened to be on that diving bell scene. And then she was like rapt at attention during that scene. And I'm like, say, yeah. Okay, this scene worked really well, because you're like, these three nuts are being lowered into molten lava. Oh my God, what are you talking about? So like, the movie itself does not hang together, but there's individual sequences that are still really powerful.
Absolutely, yeah. No, that sequence is great, and there's, you know, it's the thing is being slammed because there's earthquakes, and so it's being slammed against walls, and it's at one point the floor shockingly falls out because of course it does. It's a glass floor. And the scientist almost plunges to his death. I mean, it's a great sequence. That's the thing about this movie, is that there's an instinct there that is right. It's just that he focused on the wrong things. You know, it's one of the things that is interesting that has really changed in terms of the pacing of disaster movies in the modern era versus like the Irwin Allen era, is that in almost every movie from that era, the midpoint is when the disaster occurs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, earthquake, that it's at the midpoint. All of these movies, you have to wait a long time. I think Poseidon Adventure is an exception. I think Poseidon Adventure capsizes in the first third at the first act mark and then goes on from there. But I haven't watched that in a long time, so I can't recall for sure. And that's what happens with this movie. And as a result, there is a degree to which with this, like, you don't have enough space to really explore the true danger of it, which is these people trying to get across the island.
Right.
So I think that to a degree, this movie is hamstrung by the nature of the era itself. There's a movie we watched for the podcast recently. It's not Ashfall. It's Skyfire, and which is a Chinese and American collaboration. And it's essentially Jurassic Park meets Dante's Peak. It's about a resort where there's a volcano that has a caldera with lava in it. And like the whole thing, the whole appeal of it is you can go and like live on the edge and have this very, like, there's danger, but it's safe danger. And it feels very, there's a lot of things about it that are very similar to this movie, and make it a great companion to it. And you can see why that movie works better in terms of the sense of peril. And it's because we spend so much more time once a volcano erupts. It gives you just so much more to get to see the characters in and get to have that sense of tension that makes up for the lack of interesting things happening with the characters themselves. And yeah, that's, you know, that is what this movie, I think, is to a degree hamstrung by, is sort of the structure of the time that you do it at the midpoint. That's when you have your big, you know, because you gotta, for the midpoint, that's when you have your big spectacle. It's like, no, you gotta move the start of the spectacle up and then give us more spectacle until we're so full of spectacle that we are begging for no more spectacle. And then you give us dessert.
Yeah.
And there's always room for dessert. but yeah, no, this is, that sequence is great. Like I said, the sequence over the lava is good. The helicopter sequence, not the first one, where Paul Newman is piloting, but once they get back, everyone gets back to the hotel and Paul Newman's like, we have to leave. And some of the passengers, some of the people at the hotel go rushing to the helicopter.
Oh, that scene is great.
It's a great scene. And it's real in the sense of that is the real thing that is, you believe every moment of it. You believe that these people would be rushing over, that they'd be shoving each other off, that they would be so loaded into the helicopter that it would be too heavy, that they would lead to their own death by fear. You Yep. fully believe that. And then on top of that, you've got the people falling off of a real helicopter.
I know, right, yeah.
Into the ocean. Irwin Allen just killing people. And then the helicopter, I appreciate that the helicopter crash basically happens. I thought it was done in a way that was very good in terms of causing an emotional reaction from the viewer without being, in a more sort of remote way, that we're not inside of the helicopter. There's no one in the helicopter that we know or care about. There's no,
right, it's just the faceless mob at that point.
Yeah. And I actually think that really works because you become the characters standing on the shore watching the helicopter. You know, you become Jacqueline Bisset and Paul Newman watching with horror. You're not rooting hopelessly for someone in the helicopter. You're just going, oh my God, we're about to watch people die. And I think that's incredibly effective. And there's things that in this movie that work so well because of it. It's just that unfortunately you have to watch the Western movie to get there.
This movie loves having people fall to their deaths in front of their children.
Oh yeah. This just those two children, those poor children. I always love to think about like the therapy bill that a disaster movie child is going to have to endure afterward. And man, those kids, they go through it. And then they're just adopted. Like at my favorite, you know, we have this running joke of, you know, that the disaster movie child at the end is always just kind of like adopted by the hero.
Right.
And that's just how they work. Like if you find a stray child, you are never obligated to then find their parents or put them into the system or like find their extended family. They're just yours now. It's a real
finder's situation.
Yeah. And, you know, Irwin Allen cast his wife in a role.
Sheila,
that,
right? Sheila
yeah,
Allen
cast
playing
Sheila.
She's Shelley Wintersing this movie big time.
Exactly. She's just, Irwin was like, we couldn't get Shelley. Her quote was too high. Sheila, can you step in there and just do your best Shelley? And at the end of it, the children's father and some other male figure in their life have both fallen to their deaths in front of these kids. And Sheila is just like, well, I always wanted children and now I have them. And she's explicit, which she explicitly says it. I was like, oh, we're just, this is truly how it's working. We're going full disaster adoption. Okay. Like those kids have family somewhere. I'm like, maybe not that island gets destroyed, but like, I don't know, Sheila, that's how that works, but it's, those kids have a new mom now, whether they like it or not.
There is a very obscure law in adoption, rule in adoption law, that if you find children during a natural disaster, you can just adopt those children.
Yeah, they're just yours.
They're just yours. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but no,
that's my favorite. That's what is truly one of my favorite disaster movie tropes, is the disaster child who just kind of like, well, I'm your new mom now because your mom just died horribly. So, you know, get over it. I'm mom. Congratulations.
Why would I want you as my mother? Because you will be reminding me of how we got here. You know right. what I mean? Like, it's one thing. Yeah. Can't I go live with my uncle and my aunt? Because they have no connection to the time that my parents fell into lava and died. Like, not only do parental figures fall to their deaths in front of their children, they fall into molten lava, which is, you know, even more of a nightmarish scenario of like, oh, in this movie, if you've ever wanted to see, I don't know why you would, because everyone liked him, poor, kindly Mr. Miyagi, Pat Morita, fall into molten lava, this is your movie, because he does. Now, we don't see him, like, literally, but we you do, you know, there's the green screen and the guy, you know, the stunt guy falls. But yeah, that's the one angle where I was like, this movie's kind of mean spirited in some cases, because it cuts right to the little kids going, yeah. And you're like, well, yeah, it's really pretty terrible what we just saw. Like, it's pretty rough. So
yeah, it's one of those funny things about disaster movies where they don't really explore, like, you'll have a cute kid, but you don't really get into how these cute kids are like deeply traumatized. Mm-hmm. Like, these are not, we don't need to have a cute kid in this situation, because the whole time I'm just sitting there going like, wow, that kid just watched so many people die.
Yeah.
And they still have to be plucky. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's true how that would work. But yeah, no, this movie sends people to their deaths in very unsentimental ways.
Yeah.
Like, even with, you know, the only death where we get it, which is truly like kind of a Shelley Winters Poseidon death, is the, you know, the tightrope walker and his wife, who the wife is like amorphously, she's got what we would call mom wasting disease. I think,
yeah, she's ill. She's clearly ill of some unknown wasting away disease.
Maybe got cancer because she's got a head wrap on, but she's also European, so she could just be fabulous. Like, I was not sure. I was very surprised when I found out that they were just like former tightrope walkers, because everything about them reads as old European money. Mm-hmm. And then you find out they're tightrope walkers. And I was like, I just didn't know that was that lucrative of a career that you could then take these kinds of exotic vacations. But good for that. I should have done that instead of going to film school, honestly. But yeah, there's mostly like very unsentimental deaths, which is, again, I think a failing of the film, that we're not attached enough to these characters for the most part to then, when they die, give a damn, other than to go like, oh, the volcano's claimed another one. It's a source. It's a threat. But it doesn't have that emotional power that, you know, the deaths in Poseidon Adventure do really carry. And so I like, that's again, that failing of this film, of not really knowing what are the things that matter in a disaster movie.
Every time I see Burgess Meredith in any movie, I immediately go to a story that I heard. I think it was on a podcast or an interview that Jeff Bridges gave, because Jeff Bridges and Burgess Meredith did a movie together when Burgess Meredith always looked old, by the way. Even when he was young, he looked old. But he did a movie when Jeff Bridges was like 20 something. Like, he was just starting out. And he told Jeff Bridges, Jeff, say yes to everything.
I love it.
Jeff Bridges. And I think he kind of lived by that, because Burgess Meredith seemed to be kind of Teflon, mm-hmm. because he could be in the worst kind of Z grade garbage, and then he could be in A level productions and win Oscars. Like, he'd be in Rocky and be this thing. And then he could also be in The Manitou, you know, which we covered on the show a couple of years ago. It's like, he just was like, they say, offer to you, take it. So,
I think that's maybe that might have been a nice luxury of the like pre VHS that went,
yes.
the era when your mistakes didn't follow you.
Yes, right, exactly, right. Yeah, a bunch of.
But also, that's a great philosophy in the sense of like, yeah, say yes to the thing, take the risk, like give it a try. Like, if it's I actually really like that, especially for actors as an idea of like, yeah, say yes to it. It's not your normal thing. Try it anyway.
You'll learn something. And
it'll bring something out. It'll challenge you. It'll be good. Also, you can pay for houses. So, like, you know,
there you go.
I mean, what was it? Michael Caine basically was like, yeah, the swarm paid for my house. And it's like, okay, yeah, you know what? I can't fault that.
Sure. Why not? Death scenes wise, I did feel bad for Veronica Hamill when first of all, her death scene is amazing because she's looking in the mirror.
Yeah.
After she finds out that her husband is having an affair, her fiance is having an affair. She sees Bob and Lolani making out, and she's, you know, horrified, and she goes off, and, you know, she has stayed behind. She doesn't go with Paul Newman and the crew because she wants to stay with Bob. And of course, that's the movie. She gets screwed because of that. But like the fireball. Like, we literally see the fireball like coming through her window, and the mirror cracks, and she goes, it explodes. It's, you know, it's like, she didn't deserve that. That she seems kind of nice in the movie.
Yeah.
She's very nice to her godfather, William Holden. So when she died, I felt a little bit, I was like, oh, poor Veronica Hamill. She deserved a little better.
Yeah. But also, I think there's also the degree to which you're like, wait, that's all we get of her? Like,
yeah.
There's that sort of like there was an unfinishedness to that character that was really a bummer. Where you wanted more for her and from that character and from that actress. That sequence also feels very reminiscent of the Avalanche sequences to me. I think there's actually a very similar, even kind of shot in Avalanche of that sort of thing. But it's a good moment for sure. But I wish that I do wish that there were a little bit more of an emotional core in that, which is the downside, but still.
Yeah. I mean, the whole bridge scene at the end is it's like a half an hour long, 20
it's
minutes
the entire
long. It's a
third
big
act.
Chunk of the movie.
Yeah.
This movie's only like an hour and 45. And, you know, I said a good chunk of it is that. And that is a well done sequence. It really is. Like, it's as the bridge starts to fall apart, the rope bridge becomes more and more unstable and they move people across and they go rescue the kids and Paul Newman almost dies and all this stuff. And that whole sequence is great. And it's once it's over, it's almost like Irwin Allen and everyone they knew that there was nothing else to follow it with.
Yeah.
So our characters just walk into a cave and spend the night in the cave kind of talking, and then they come out and they're like, oh, now we're safe. And you're like, oh, that was the end?
Okay. That's it. And then you see how high up they were and you realize, like, you probably didn't have to go that far. Like, they really trek, and when you see the elevation, it's like, oh, that seemed possibly unnecessary, actually. But what's funny is that it's a fairly low death count for characters that we are spending time with, like,
right,
other than
right.
Like, I was expecting, because it is mostly just the bridge sequence, so that means we have there's a brief sequence where they're like scaling a very narrow ledge, and we lose the disaster children's dad to that, and he falls to his death. But otherwise, and then you lose Pat on the bridge, but for the most part the whole team makes it.
Yeah,
even the like bar floozies that Sheila and Pat have brought along, who I don't think of any lines or even character names. They just have midriffs. And those characters, I think both of them make it, at least one does, which it's like, well, we're to a degree, I feel like you do have to kill more people in the process of getting to safety to make me believe that it was truly dangerous all the way versus this one obstacle. And that was the thing that surprised me, was that there weren't more disaster scenarios to kind of weed out that group that was making the trip.
Yeah, like Edward Albert survives, you know, and like he has almost nothing to do in this movie. You know, he used to kind of headline movies in the early 70s, and here he's kind of, I don't say slumming it, but it's kind of a lower gear for someone that used to headline movies, and he survives. So you're like, wow, yeah, they really, I guess Irwin, as he was getting older, maybe got a little soft. He was like, I don't want to kill.
There's no moment of great sacrifice, which is really what's surprising. Normally in these movies, there's at least like one moment. I mean, Shelley Winters making the great sacrifice of being the only one who can hold her breath that long, and it causes the heart attack. There's normally at least a couple of things of these great sacrifice moments where that really, in the third act especially, bring you in and remind you that like no one is safe. And this movie doesn't have that. It doesn't. I mean, Paul Newman dangling off the side of a bridge while holding onto a child. You know, Paul Newman's going to make it.
Would have been like, amazing, though, right?
Oh, my God.
Pulled him off.
Well, I mean, the exception of that, I say all this, and the exception of that is Charlton Heston dying in Earthquake, which to this day, like, it's been at least a year since I watched it, and I'm still like, did that really happen? Because it's so unexpected, because you don't kill the main star. But I had to assume Paul Newman had contract armor, you know? Like, there was no way that Paul Newman was dying by falling off of a bridge into lava. But so you need that other like great sense of peril and sacrifice that this movie never quite comes through on. And I think that's partly because I don't know the other characters well enough to have that moment.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I think I think an example of kind of how DOA this movie was when it debuted, and then its shelf life, because I went online and searched for like the trailer. I wanted to run like a clip of the trailer, and I couldn't find the trailer for it online anywhere, but I found a Warner Brothers trailer for when it got released on VHS. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to run it at the end of the show, so you'll get to hear it. It has a narrator, and I kid you not, making fun of the very movie that they're selling. you've got a narrator like, can we have one more explosion in here? I'm like, wow, like Warner Brothers themselves is selling the movie while also telling you, yeah, this isn't very good, but maybe buy it anyway. $29.99 manufacturer suggested retail price. I'm like, what a weird, it's like, what's happening? And I'm like, Irwin Allen deserved better than that. He made a lot of money for his studios. Deserved better than that. Like, that's not fair.
Yeah, but, that's brutal.
Yeah. So I could see why maybe he was like, all right, let's go back to TV and just do stuff there and I'll be happy. And then he passed away in 1991. It really was the sort of an end of an era. So, okay, going by your rating system for your own show, Amanda, how many Towering Infernos would you give When Time Ran Out?
It's getting a 2.5 for me. I'm going to rank this one really low. It just, there was so little about this movie that truly worked. I mean, yes, I watched it and it was entertaining for the hour 45, in that sense of like, I wasn't wishing that I could get out of it, but there's nothing about it that this is the worst version of the form to me. And that's a bummer because I really wanted to like it. I wanted to have this added to my disaster movie repertoire. And yeah, just it's truly the kind of the worst version of the form. Strongly recommend watching Skyfire to see a good version of Volcano Hotel destruction. Very similar, some very good similar fireball sequences at the hotel. Think there's a disaster child who gets adopted. You know, there's a lot of similarities in certain ways, but it's this one just didn't do it for me. I wish it had. How about you? How many Towering Infernos you giving this?
I'm going to be a little on the kinder side and give it a 3 just because I can't objectively say it's a good movie. Would I recommend it to anybody? Not really. But there were enough fun sequences that I was like, okay, the diving bell sequence, the bridge sequence, watching James Franciscus get destroyed by a fireball. Like all that was fun to the point where I'm like, it's the kind of, and I don't like to say this about movies because they're even in their worst, they're still art forms and they deserve your full attention. But it's the kind of movie where you're kind of like an idle Sunday afternoon and maybe you've got something to kind of like do laundry, you know, and you want something on in the background. This is that kind of movie where during the talk sequences, which are not particularly well done, the scene with Paul Newman and Jacqueline Bisset, where they do lovey-dovey on the beach, all that stuff is pretty, pretty boring. That stuff you can look away from, and it doesn't matter if you leave the room to go put the basket of laundry away for 2 minutes. But if you come back and you can see the bravura sequences, then it's fun. So I would, maybe 3 is generous, but that's where I'm going with Towering. How many Towering Infernos out of 5?
I think 3 is perfectly reasonable ranking. I think I'm probably being a little harsh on it.
But you've seen a lot more than me, so you've seen a lot of better examples of the
yeah. Genre. I mean, we try to, you always try to rank the grade the movie against not necessarily other movies, but against what it's trying to accomplish. It's kind of how I think of it is like, you got to take it on its own terms. So, which is why, I can't rank a made-for-TV movie on the scale to, a Roland Emmerich, You got to take it as it comes. I think that of this movie, of what this movie was trying to accomplish is why it kind of hits the 2.5 for me, is because it's like it knew what it was aiming for and it didn't meet what it was aiming for. And that's always just kind of like, it's a bummer, Like, wanted it to be better than it was.
Absolutely. So one last thing I wanted to mention as we're signing off here. I've never been to one of these, but the idea of, have you ever seen a movie in 4DX? That thing where like they shoot
where
water
they, like,
at you.
Where they rumble the seats.
The seats. It sounds horrible, right? Yeah. That does not sound like anything I'd want to go. That said, if they decided to do a 4DX up conversion of like Poseidon Adventure or Towering Inferno, that I would pay like $30 to go experience because that would probably be really fun.
Oh, absolutely. That I want seats that tilt. Yes, I want to watch exactly. I want to watch the Poseidon Adventure from increasingly high angles as the ship capsizes. Like, give me all of that. That's the fun of like Paul Feig has talked about it on the podcast of like going to see Earthquake with like the Rumble Vision seats when he was a kid.
That's great.
And it's like, yeah, that's great. Give us, I'm not big on the 3D thing. Like,
no,
I'm not big on 3D glasses.
Nope.
But sure, give me a gimmick with a disaster movie. Why not? Like, if there's any form to do it with, it's disaster. Absolutely.
Totally. Yeah. So yeah, somebody get on that. So, well, Amanda, thank you so much for doing this. Like I said, I'm such a big fan of the show, and I'm just so happy when I can get to have somebody from a show that I like on my show. It's just so exciting to me. So thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you again for asking me. It was great to be here.
All right. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
So I am on Disaster Girls Podcast, which is available on all the available podcasting networks. And then I'm Amanda Smith Says on Twitter. And then if you're on Blue Sky, I managed to get Amanda Smith as my handle, which I'm very excited.
Oh, my fancy. God.
I've never gotten to be an early enough adopter on anything to be able to get first name, last name when your last name is Smith.
Right.
And it's finally happened. And I'm just like, this makes me feel like I've arrived more than any verification on like Twitter could have ever done. But yeah. So, I'm always constantly perpetually online. So you can find me there. And, other thing I'm going to plug is disastergirls.myshopify.com is the podcast merch store, which is kind of like been my new fun side project of having no visual design skills, and trying to do it anyway. But we have like, in particular, the thing I'm most proud of is our Stop Killing Shelley Winters collection. So if you are a Poseidon Adventure fan, if you are a Shelley Winters devotee like myself, because that's one of the favorite, like the fact that she survived tentacles was thrilled me beyond measure. I was like, finally, because she died so, a city on fire, they kill her off in such an inglorious way. And Poseidon Adventure, gotta stop killing Shelley Winters. The thing I feel most strongly about in life. So you can get all sorts of stuff that have that logo on it if that happens to be the thing that you're interested in. So that's all my pluggables.
That's an absolutely worthy endeavor to stop
Thank
trying
you.
To kill Shelley Winters.
Stop killing Shelley Winters.
It's fantastic. My favorite, they tell this story in that movie. I think it's Swimming with Sharks with Kevin Spacey, where my favorite Shelley Winters story is where she had to audition for some producer.
It was Poseidon.
What? Oh, was it? Was it the one where she whips out the two Oscars and puts them on the desk and she's like, yep. Some people think I can act.
She was incredible. Yeah, that she asks her audition and she just puts them down on a table. Like, yeah, she's fantastic. Shelley Winters was like just the best.
That's a baller. We talked about her in, she was in John Garfield's last movie. He Ran All the Way, which we've covered on the show a couple episodes ago. She's terrific in that. So yeah, she's absolutely terrific. So, and she's missed here. You can tell, but when a movie has someone be that type of person.
Yeah.
You know that they are significant to the success of the project when they can't get them. So let's get the kind of D-level version or the squint if you look hard version, because we need to have that kind of person in the movie, but we can't get her. So I'll just get my wife and have her be the, Shelley Winters.
You know, when in doubt, just call in the wife to play one of the greatest actresses of her generation.
Sure. Why not? Again, thank you so much, Amanda. And thank you everybody for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of Fade Out on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're on Twitter at Fade Out Pod. And if you want to support the Fine Water Networks, go to patreon.com/FW podcast. There you can lock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Monique D for her support of Fade Out. I really do appreciate it. So thanks for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script. So it's time to fade out.
There's not going to be any evacuation.
Another non-believer. Won't they ever learn? Only this guy's problem is a small matter of a very active volcano.
This thing's a powder keg.
Well, I think that's a damned irresponsible conclusion on your part.
Oh, well, then perhaps there's still time for a little passion in paradise. That's some kiss. Passion that really sparks. But this sucker makes Mount St. Helens look like a kid's sparkler.
Irresponsible conclusion on your part.
You said that already. Paul Newman, Jacqueline Bisset, William Holden, James Franciscus, Alex Karras, Pat Morita. Excuse me, don't we have any other explosions? Thank you. Burgess Meredith and Hill Street's Veronica Hamill. They were all having a good time when time ran out.